Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Talking Critic, the only podcast that makes HUD look like Chud, and I love Chud. I'm your host, Pig-Eyed Smellstick Bob Mackey, and this is the Laser Time Podcast Network's chronological exploration of the critic, who is here with me today.
Henry Gilbert and Blink, more like Stink.
And who else?
151-foot-tall woman with needs, Diana Goodman.
And who else?
Filling in for Micropar is Chris Killslaw Antista.
I'm making Killslaw. And today's episode is Miserable.
It's not just about sex. We want to make love to our mothers.
Excellent. Today's episode aired on February 16th, 1994, and Henry will tell us what movies came out this week in real world history.
Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book!
Oh boy, Bobby! Hey, in theaters premiering this weekend, Steven Seagal kills people to save the environment in On Deadly Ground.
Yes! Ooh.
Shaq makes his big screen debut with Nick Nolte in Blue Chips.
Oh boy.
And Winona Ryder, Ethan Hawke, and Ben Stiller all teach the world about Gen X in Reality Bites.
Hey, that shit.
It's a great soundtrack.
What an annoying movie.
Is that what that sounds like when someone else...
Was that exciting to hear, Chris?
It was. I have no idea how you do the show, by the way. Mike Rapores is on assignment at E3 by his employers.
But unfortunately, he was very upset that he could not be here. I asked him specifically, is there any things you want me to bring up? And just how much he loves this episode. It was like, I just tell him I love it. I'm like, I will. Just,
he's here in spirit, at least.
Exactly.
How the fuck do you... This is uncensored, right?
Yes.
How the fuck do you do this show? In The Simpsons, we have to describe every single reference. Mm. And there's a reference every 6 seconds. And there's almost nothing out of bounds to be referenced.
It's true.
And on this show, and it's just alarming. I was writing them down like, dude, I watched every one of these things live when they were happening. Every reference I know, this the biggest one being... Missouri, I believe the movie's called. Missouri by Stephen King.
Oh, Missouri, right. Yeah, well,
I don't know how you guys do this. Is that why it went 90 minutes last time? You got to explain
it. We had to explain the origins of the show, too.
Right.
So,
We did the theme music.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole background.
This should be a little shorter.
Back to the theaters, real quick. I remember Steven Seagal's On Deadly Ground. It was when he got all the power. He's like, we're going to make a film about what I want to do, and that is environmentalism in Alaska. And I murder people to prevent them
gonna
from exploiting.
I'm going to have Joan Chen play a Native American. Oh, then I'm going to give a 20-minute speech after about saving the Earth after I blow up a bunch of oil rigs.
Yeah, make her get naked and use an unrecyclable Coke bottle as a gun silencer. I believe that also happened.
Isn't he just a bloated sheriff somewhere now?
No.
You would say that, but Maggie.
It is something to behold. Oh, Michael Caine cashing that check.
Oh, my God. Michael Caine is in it?
It's a great bad movie.
Oil. Mike, stay well. Go around.
Steven Seagal actually is referenced in this episode. Reality Bites would influence a million indie filmmakers to make better films than that one.
It's the directorial debut of Ben Stiller and a huge role for Janine Garofalo, and the soundtrack is fun.
It's a good soundtrack.
You stay. And Blue Chips with Shaq playing a basketball player, him and Penny Hardaway.
I thought that was the one where Sinbad played a genie.
No.
That was Red Chips.
Blue Chips
That's also the one I saw.
Has a good soundtrack. For some reason, I had that song somewhere. I play with Blue Chips and they're all on the table. What?
If you're a college basketball fan, it stars every coach plays themselves except Nick Nolte, and it's really weird.
Getting murdered out there.
The Nick Nolte is playing a Bobby Knight type, but then he faces Bobby Knight in the end of the movie.
I was going to say, why don't they fight to the death? They're the two angriest middle-aged men I've ever seen in my life.
Well, unfortunately, Nick Nolte's team gets caught doing point shaving, and he has to admit to it, and so they forfeit.
I don't know what that is.
Point shaving is a gambling thing where there is the spread. You don't just bet on this team will beat that team. It's about points. And so if you're gambling on that game and know how many points to be in to win something, then you just score less points at the end of a game. Like, you're like, well, we can't be 20 ahead. We need to be 10 ahead. So I'm not going to try as hard.
Okay.
Yeah, that is the point.
Makes sense.
Shoot this basket a little bit off.
Stay away from the 3-point line. So this episode is Miserable. It's a parody of the 1990 film and 1987 novel Misery about an insane, obsessive fan of an author who kidnaps him and tortures him and forces him to write the ideal version of his stories that she wants for herself.
Yes, it's a wonderful movie.
The origin of Twitter, essentially.
It is. Well,
I didn't like the thing that you made. It wasn't what I wanted.
It's violent fan fiction.
Bad obsessive...
Violent fan fiction.
Bad obsessive fans have always existed. Twitter just gives them more... Social media gives them even more like the spotlight. But you know Stephen King had been getting getting letters from Annie Wilkins' characters his whole life, for, just telling him, like, this character in Dark Tower shouldn't do this. This is all wrong. And it's his nightmare. It's a perfect nightmare scenario.
There's no Hitchmage in The Shining? That's actually just Stephen King.
Yes, but him getting trapped and forced with violence to write the story that somebody else wants him to write, that is the biggest nightmare for him. And that's also Stephen King in a nutshell. Of just that he always is like, well, who's the best person to be the lead in this story? A writer!
From Maine, no less.
A writer from Maine.
Yeah. Maybe with a drinking problem.
It's such a great film, I feel like was like heavily in the cultural zeitgeist that has since disappeared. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it made Kathy Bates a star. Yes. I know she was in other stuff, but...
She won the Oscar.
It was quite a coup that she got it, but... since we're getting into Misery now, I wanted to play my favorite scene from Misery. And as the kids would say on Twitter, this is extremely me.
My favorite was Rocket Man. And once it was a No Brakes chapter. And the bad guys stuck him in a car on a mountain road, knocked him out, and welded the door shut, and tore out the brakes, and started him to his death. And he woke up and tried to steer and tried to get out, but the car went off a cliff before he could escape. And it crashed and burned, and I was so upset and excited. And the next week, you better believe I was first in line. And they always start with the end of the last week. And there was Rocket Man trying to get out. And here comes the cliff. And just before the car went off the cliff, he jumped free. And all the kids cheered. But I didn't cheer. I stood right up and started shouting, "This isn't what happened last week! Have you all got amnesia? They just cheated us! This isn't fair! He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodie car!"
Wow.
The cock-a-doodie car, yes.
I love that.
I feel bad about everything I've said about Lost on one of these podcasts at this point.
This villain has an origin story. She was bitten by a radioactive bad cereal and turned into a psychotic, story-obsessed woman.
But that's so identifiable to me. I'm just like, I've seen that a million times. Of like, yes, that's not... That's a cheat. That's bad writing. This is all built up.
It's you talking about Man of Steel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It is within the world that you built. You can't cheat your way out of it.
Superman can't break a cock-a-doodie neck.
Anyway, I love that scene. But the character in this episode isn't completely really mess around with what she is or her drive. But
we hear a little of her origin story, but she doesn't go as intense as Kathy Bates.
She starts completely differently, I think, as well. Because there's no romance with James Caan and Kathy Bates.
She has a couple different things that she's trying to accomplish simultaneously.
Yeah, they kind of depends the plot on that.
It depends on the scene.
Can I just say that, like, I was watching a ton of cheapy horror movies, Nightmare on Elm Street, at this time, and I saw this film, and it contained one of the most disturbing sequences ever, where she kidnaps her favorite author, and so he can't leave, puts a block between his ankles, and just gets on a bed and whacks both feet with a sledgehammer in until they break almost in half. And, like, that is the most disgusting, it's unnerving thing I've seen. I watch horror movies every day.
In the book, it's not a hobbling with a sledgehammer. I think she cuts off one of his feet with an axe.
And he wakes up with it gone.
Yeah.
It's more of the terror of waking up without your foot instead of the graphic, like, smashing your foot on screen.
I think it's so much worse this way with the smashing. Yeah. And then I think she says, "I love you so much."
It just, not to get ahead of everything, but that's the only reason the stinger of this episode makes any sense, walking with a cane, because that's they film James Caan that way.
And I also love
For Misery.
At the end of Misery, the way he beats her is that he writes her the perfect fan fiction that fulfills everything she ever wanted, and then he burns it in front of her and she can't take it. She gets distracted enough that he could attack her back, and the way she just goes, like, "No, my misery!" Like, this, her, one of her last words is like, "This is mine, my thing." And apparently Stephen King, well, not apparently, Stephen King had a similar accident to what happens to the lead in Misery, which is he gets in a car accident in the middle of nowhere and is saved by her. That's how she kidnaps him. Mm-hmm. It was just lucky on her part that she gets him. And Stephen King was hit by a car in real life and was saved by somebody off the side of the road. But I'm just saying, if you're Stephen King, who imagined that scenario, who then gets hit by a car and wakes up in a stranger's house, that's got to be pretty crazy.
The EMT didn't say, "I'm your biggest fan," though. So I want to say, Al Jean and Mike Reese, they ran seasons 3 and 4 of The Simpsons, and their last episode was Cape Fear, a very specific movie parody of a recent movie. This is very much like that, in that it's not strictly beat for beat, but they pull the strongest scenes and build an episode around those scenes.
Yeah.
And I will also say, like, we just did the Talking Duckman episode, and we were kind of impressed by how well they treated their female character. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a psychotic female character, but I noticed this is one of a few instances in an Al Jean and Mike Reese show where they don't name the female character.
Yeah.
It's weird. They just forget to, like, the waitress at Moe's Bar who comes in the Flaming Moe's episode, she is not given a name. In this episode, this woman, clearly Annie from Misery, is not even given a name. I was surprised.
I was shocked. I kept waiting for Jay to say her name, and he never does.
Yeah, and when I was taking notes, I was like, and then the woman does, oh, wait, what's her name again? I'll just wait, and it never happened. So I was like, what a weird choice. I don't know why.
And this is the second in production order, and this is the second episode that ends with a woman betraying Jay or lying to Jay the entire time.
And it opens with a, we'll get to that, but it opens with an alimony joke.
Yes, well, so this isn't, so we are going in production order on this show, not air order like we do on Talking
Simpsons. This did not air second.
It aired fourth, and it, I think it was because it was more lurid sex for Jay right after the one night stand in the first episode, right? ABC was just like, no, you can't have two sex episodes in a row.
It was really Fox style humor on ABC, and they weren't ready for it, especially after or before Home Improvement, whenever this show aired.
That was a continuing problem Reese and Gene were faced with, that they were hired to make a Fox show, and then when they delivered a Fox show, ABC's like, but this is on with Home Improvement.
He's taking off his shirt.
How ribald. Well, I mean, they, on the commentary, it sounds like this show almost ended the critic. ABC was ready to pull out, like, oh, we didn't know we were signing up for this. And James L. Brooks, the savior of many a thing that we love, stood in the way. Like, he is like the immovable force when you're making a TV show. It's like, he will protect you from any notes or anything like that. And they were able to, I'm surprised that they even aired the rest of the season with how much they hated the show.
Well, and that, while James L. Brooks has that power to be like, you don't want to piss me, James L. Brooks, off. Like, you'll probably work with me at some point again.
He is the Monopoly guy.
I went to a Q&A with him, but I think it's kind of the opposite. He's really nice.
Yeah.
And he's willing to say anything, and he was willing to address any question, but just, shucks. Come on, guys. We're not going to end this whole thing over this.
I think he's powerful and nice, and people also respect him for what he's made. So they always defer to him, and they don't want to question his judgment.
I wanted to bring it up in the Laser Time Simpsons episode that he... James L. Brooks has an astounding output in that he hasn't done as much as you think, but everything he does is generally mega successful unless it's Spanglish.
Yes.
And the other movie after that I saw.
The last 10, 15 years of it.
But he usually makes he makes like a movie once every 10 years, and sometimes it's as good as it gets. And
well, he's in the retiree movie maker phase now. He's just like, if every few years he feels like making a movie, he can make it.
But at this time, he was enormously successful. Didn't make a movie every year, made a movie every 4 years, and it critically performed well, financially. He had a lot of power.
So the opening jokes on this one, in the opening... The phone call is kind of a weak one, though. It's rare when Margo would call him for the phone jokes. Eventually, celebrities just call him and be like, it's my hoo-ha, hello.
I mean, I normally don't connect the phone call to the story itself, but it's weird that he wakes up in the intro and then he wakes up again at the beginning of the episode.
That's true. And then the joke is a Raiders of the Lost Ark joke is the cartoon one, and that feels very safe for them. Like, it's always like... Last Crusade was 5 years old at this point.
I mean, Muppet Babies did a Raiders joke. It's perfectly fine
it's
for everybody.
It's right when he says, when your room was kind of weird.
Exactly.
So Jay wakes up in the morning, and he wakes up next to a pizza box, which I've never woken up next to a pizza box, but I have woken up thinking, like, I've got a cold pizza.
If I've done it, I assume you've done it.
I put that pizza in the fridge before bed.
I usually wake up cradling my iPad like a lover.
Yes. Well, mine is my phone in bed. It's just like, okay, phone's over here. And then they get an angry ex-wife joke, which doesn't really... Him being divorced has nothing to do with this episode, so it's just an ex-wife joke.
How much did that enter into the first episode?
They needed to establish he was a single father.
But you don't see his wife, though.
No, this is the first time we do see Ardith, who doesn't come up that often, but I think this is just underlining how shitty Jay's life is, how lonely he is. The one woman he married put a billboard outside his house saying how much alimony he owes, and definitely this is an Al Jean joke. On the commentary, he's like, that is not a lot of alimony. You could tell Al Jean is paying out the nose to some ex-wives.
It's like $70,000 or something. Yeah. Well, also, should we mention Newlywed Game? There's a flashback to them going on the Newlywed Game.
Let's give a listen.
Now, Jay, your wife, Ardith, said you had the sex appeal of...
A dead mackerel. We won! We won! Ugh.
Do people know what the Newlywed Game is anymore?
I mean, I do.
I'm assuming it's coming back again.
I believe it's on TV now, or had a recent reboot.
Is it famous in clip packages for a butt sex joke?
Yeah.
The most famous one. The host wasn't Wink Martindale, or was it Wink Martindale?
Maybe Diana can explain the Newlywed Game, the 70s version.
Actually, there's a version on, I just saw an ad for this, like celebrities and their kids. But the idea is you ask one half of a couple a question while the other half is out of the room. And they write down what they think the other person's going to say. And then you bring this other, you know, let's say the wife back, and you say, like, you know, how much does your wife's chest weigh? And
we weighed your wife's tits, and we know the answer.
Or, you know, like, what's the first thing he does every time he wakes up? You know, and then they...
Or what's his least favorite thing about his mother-in-law?
Yeah, or, yeah. I mean, the salacious ones were like... Where was the weirdest place you made whoopee?
That's what I know.
It popularized the word whoopee.
Whoopee. I couldn't say fucking.
And the famous moment that the host actually for the longest time denied happened, and then they found the footage of it, and then he had to do like a mea culpa on one of those like clip show packages. Like I thought this never happened, but it did. I'm right there.
Butt sex show.
So they asked
it was the weirdest place you've ever made whoopee. I think it was.
And then she said, and in the butt.
And she was like, wait, what does he mean? Like in the ass?
Yeah, in the ass. And
Kevin Smith would take it and be a running joke in Mallrats, like the back of the
book. They had many dirty jokes like that. They said, on your wedding night, was he a good boy or a bad boy? He's like, bad boy. And then she goes, Harold, who say that you were a good boy?
The theme song is what I remember from it. We use it a lot in Laser Time. We're doing quiz shows. And it's by Chuck Barris. That's another story for another time, but he was a famous maker of game show hosts that got thrust into the spotlight of host and then made a movie about it, and it's insane.
I guess they were cheap. They did not pay for the Newlywed Game music in that clip. Yeah. I should mention, too, this episode is written by Steve Levitan.
Yeah.
Big-ass deal. Not in 1994, though, but just a couple years later, he will create the perfectly cromulent show, Just Shoot Me.
It was the wings of its time.
Yes. Well, it was wings, except Mr. Show actors were on it all the time.
Yes. It was Mr. Show adjacent.
And he would create 8 million other sitcoms. Those most other popular one is Modern Family.
Oh, really? Oh. That's Steve Levitan. Yes. Damn.
Yep.
In the Michael Showalter book, he talks about how every year for several years he would audition for the new Steve Levitan project.
God, he's got to have more money than the richest kings of Europe by now.
He's like the underrated Shonda Rhimes. Where he's just under the radar making $80 million a year.
he's like Chuck Lorre's understudy.
Yes, yeah, right. Totally.
Quietly a billionaire.
And this is how it began, writing the Misery episode.
And he wrote on Wings.
Speaking of Wings, yes,
he's a Wings guy.
He was working on Wings while doing these shows. on the commentary,
but
knock
also
wings.
To redeem him, the Larry Sanders Show.
Oh, cool!
Hooray. Nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the next, I guess, 5 minutes are just a series of rapid fire jokes about how lonely and horny Jay is.
Yeah,
everyone else is in love, and he's alone.
Severed heads, taxi drivers.
So in general, the concurrent Simpsons would not spend this long on the one series of jokes, like. Over and over again, they're like, he's lonely, he's lonely, he's lonely. And Simpsons would have had a more involved 5-minute thing to then lead into the real point of the
episode.
Would
have been more plot on the way, along the way of those jokes. And
I like
the Mr. Snrub version of Jay Sherman with the big mustache that catches the woman.
That was Guy Incognito. Who it was.
He's got the Mr. Snrub mustache, though.
Incognito has a mustache,
but I like the way Snrub thinks.
What I really love about the critic, one of the main things that's right out there in front, and I don't know if you guys said it in the last episode, is that Jay Sherman looks nothing like any other character in the universe.
Yeah,
he is portrayed to be an outsider. There is nobody with that body type, that face type, and that doesn't just involve him being Jewish, because there are rabbis all over the show.
I think it's also because he is the one character created by David Silverman who doesn't work on the show. So he does look unique in that sense.
I think that highlights his outsider nature and being lonely, because he doesn't look like he fits in on the streets of New York. And I almost, just the second episode that there's a doppelganger joke sort of bummed me out.
He's a bizarre pear man.
Mm-hmm. He goes around feeling lonely. I like the joke about the New York newspapers. And I was going to look to our newspaper expert, Diana. So were these impressions of what the Post and the Daily News were doing then?
And I feel like that there's the severed heads to wed. I sort of feel like is a reference to severed head or headless man found in topless bar. One of the most famous headlines ever.
I searched on Google for New York Post severed head, and they're like, there were 10 stories from the last few years about severed head in headlines.
Every headline in the New York Post is a Simpsons joke, or could be, right?
Mm. Yeah. Well, yeah. They love puns, and they love big headlines. Yeah.
Just
well,
giant
and
words.
Then, and then the other one, New York to New York, I heart you. And Mayor has heart attack way under it. That's I really feel like that's totally a reference to Prez to New York City drop dead.
Yeah.
Which was about New York City was going to go bankrupt. They tried to have President Ford get federal money to bail them out, and Ford said no. So the headline was I think it was Ford to New York drop dead.
Wow. All right. So actually, I had one clip I wanted to play here. When I think of the New York Post, I don't live in New York. I don't read the New York Post. But I think of this great joke from John Mulaney, comedian John Mulaney, about the New York Post.
I like reading the New York Post because reading the New York Post is like talking to someone who heard the news and now they're trying to give you the gist. It's like you get the same amount of information if you grab someone on the street and you were like, what happened today? And they're like, it's a perv in Queens. You'd be like, all right, thank you.
I love that bit.
Yeah, I feel like New York is the only city that still has a city tabloid. Or more than one, really.
Yeah.
Well, they'll be the last news place, though. Bob and I walked around Manhattan this year, didn't see many newsstands.
Nope.
So a lot of people selling, well, the hot dog carts are now more like turkey kebab carts. Like, they'll give you a hot dog, too, but they got turkey kebabs, and I do not like this multicultural, that's a joke, Jeff.
A taco truck on every corner.
Yeah, Jay, I can identify with Jay walking around and feeling depressed and lonely. That's easy to identify with.
There's a great do the right thing joke.
Oh. Yeah. Like, yeah.
That was Wookie, you found my trash can.
And then they hug.
Yeah, so I thought that was the line from the episode, like, hey, Sal, I got something for you, but I rewatched it. All he says is, hey, and then he throws the trash can.
Yeah.
And Do the Right Thing is an amazing film. I love Spike Lee movies. Even the bad ones are good. I mean,
it's not fair to say this, but I think it's his best movie.
It's a masterpiece.
I think so.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Malcolm X is a close second.
And it was made in 1989, but it is still like the most relevant take on racism ever.
It's great. It's a really good litmus test for how do you feel about certain things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's really interesting.
No, it's an amazing film, and sadly, it is exactly today, too.
Not much has changed.
But it's that scene in Critic was another one of those, in the second episode they're doing of like, you're walking by a movie, like you have a show that lets you that lets you parody movies all the time just by watching it, but they're like, no, he walks by a movie, and that Spike Lee is drawn not to be, he is called Mookie.
Yes.
Right. He is called Mookie by the Danny Aiello character, Sal.
Right.
But he is like drawn as Spike Lee of 1994 with the Malcolm X hat and the goatee Mookie doesn't have.
Outside of Mike Myers, one of the most famous people to constantly wear a hat with a logo of the movie on it.
Yeah, I love that.
It's true.
It's either Malcolm X or a Knicks hat. That's his thing. So,
but I love that about the Critic, that it doesn't, it eschews the cutaway gag by either throwing to what is a movie clip or the movie is happening around Jay Sherman.
Yeah, he just
walks
by it. And then comes the first in a long series of gags that prisoners love Jay Sherman.
Yeah.
Dear Jay, I think you're the sexiest man alive. Well, I'm currently a resident of the New York Men's Correctional Institution. Oh.
He throws it in the pile marked letters from prison.
It's not explicitly a prison rape joke, but Mike Reiss would say that's not the proudest legacy of the Critic, all the prison rape jokes.
Yeah, they had a lot of those.
It was an easy button to push back in the day.
I don't hear it as a prison rape joke, though.
Not that one. But when that came up on the commentary, Mike Reiss was like,
it's just a desperate weirdo.
Yeah.
In Diana, I have a matching out-of-date print reference for you. And a super brief period at the magazine PC Gamer. My favorite thing I ever did was I was the editor of the letter section. I wanted to do that.
Oh,
I wanted to make funny responses to people. And the amount of letters that come from prisoners who have a ton of time and will not hesitate to write back about a magazine. Write to a magazine that was donated to them 3 years after it was published.
Did they release Doom 2 yet?
Wow.
And a ton of mail. Like, this is... It'll look like a really weird letter, It's clearly been opened and sealed again.
Yes.
And then you'll read it. And then one of the weirdest things was, can we publish this? I have to look up what this person did.
Oh.
Whether or not we can publish this.
I remember a couple prison letters then that were, a lot of them were more about, like, when I get out, I'm going to buy this video game.
Yes,
or I'm
it was totally
this.
Like that.
It was planning a video game.
Are people still playing Asheron's Call? Like, sorry, man, I don't know what to tell you. Oh, look, that's what you're charged with. I don't care what you think.
Your character has been deleted.
And then there was a kind of lame phone sex joke that I would not bother even clipping.
No.
And,
I mean,
and
he wants to eat an entire bathtub full of Jell-O.
Yes. The idea of three women at once is kind of gross to him, except for the Jell-O. And then there's, I don't even want to play it, there's just a lame old anti-trans joke.
Yeah.
You know what's weird? I was thinking about this because, first of all, I have to say the animation of him in the subway car, the fact that it's got, like, the fluorescent lighting is a really nice touch.
It's a very well-animated show.
Yeah, but the idea is, he bumps up against a beautiful woman and she, you know, thinks to herself, I wonder if he knows I'm a man. There's actually a pro-trans way you could read that, which I'm sure they did not intend at the time.
Absolutely
but
not.
She could be a trans man who hasn't started transitioning yet. She looks like a woman, but she's thinking, but inside I'm a man. I don't want to date him.
Are you their lawyer?
Boy, I mean, that is the most friendly reading I've
ever
read.
I'd love to read it that way,
yes.
But the joke is like, she's got a dick.
She's got a dick. Yeah,
but she's still gorgeous.
Oh, yeah,
she's
I'd
a nice
bang her.
Person.
So. Just move the balls out of the way and find the new vagina.
Actually, this comedian had this... they talked about lazy anti-trans jokes like these on an amazing Dana Gould Hour podcast about this. And this guy had this great response. He had this great joke about it to guys. He's like, you fooled me. And he just like, then it works. Like, then well, who cares?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You thought it was a woman because they are a woman. Then don't be mad. Like, they're a woman then. Like, and it's just, I don't even like. She is a woman. That just even that way of thinking, like I'm a man, like a trans person. I don't.
They wouldn't
believe,
think that
in their head. Like, would they know I'm a man? Like, so it's just, it's gross. But it also, it just bothers me in that I know this is the SJW minute, but it bothers me that that had no lip movement to it. So whatever that could have been, like the 17th joke they put in there,
and it
that
might
could
have been
a rewrite. Yeah. And if then the rewrite was just a lazy joke of like it's a girl who's a guy, like then it's like ugh,
saying
that's
it's like a Quiplash game. It was
totally.
It just happened to be the best one.
They just that's the one they settled on. Yeah. I was like, it had no lip sync. It would have been so easy to rewrite any number of jokes in there that she could have said like. Does he know that I'm wearing a diaper right now? Does he know that I've murdered 8 men? Does she? Yeah.
Not to beat this to death, and this is not even a defense. It's just my judgment on New York was largely based on this kind of shit and Letterman monologues.
Yeah.
And they made it sound like.
Well, the idea that
Manhattan
the subway
was a bastion
of...
for transvestites.
Yes.
That's the basis for like 10 years of Letterman monologues, I swear to Christ.
Yes, it is.
It was once extremely funny.
Yep. It was a different time.
Actually, I have a new interpretation. You could also interpret it as it is a male, possibly heterosexual transvestite who just gets off on passing as a woman in public. But actually lives as a man.
Could be, but they... Yeah.
I know, we've thought about this so much more than the writers did.
We need to get Skype Steve Levitan, and we'll get him on this. And
well, it wouldn't be fair to Steve Levitan, because it's like, he probably... Who knows he even wrote that?
Yeah, who wrote the
joke? It
could
have been a rewrite, like... I don't want to... Steve Levitan has done a lot of nice things for gay people with the Modern Family show.
Oh, yeah.
Main Street, but, all right, let's get to a funnier joke about a naked Statue of Liberty.
So desperate.
Yes. He is this desperate. He is imagining... Out of all the people he could imagine naked, he picks this one.
There's the greatest woman in New York. You know, when you really look at her, she's pretty hot.
Jay, I'm more than just a symbol. I'm a 151-foot woman with needs.
Oh, sweet Liberty.
Yeah.
He's told to not fantasize about the size.
Yeah, she drops that toga. She's got some shapely legs,
I like how the giant... like clang
really
as it hits
fully.
The ground.
It's
yeah.
really good, yeah. And then also he tries to go home to not feel lonely, and he gets quite a shock.
Mom, Dad, I've decided to come home because I'm feeling so unloved. Oh, my God.
Maybe you should have knocked first.
Well, who knew you still...
I'm as shocked as you are.
All right, so we talk about a lot of Simpsons phrases that are made into our lexicon People who have been listening to me for a long time know I say that constantly. And it was mind-blowing to see it again. Franklin, I think I said it somewhere else, is my favorite character in the show.
He's great.
Oh, yeah.
He's great in this episode. There's jokes in this that I was like, oh, he said it in here. Mm-hmm.
He was Ralph Wiggum before Ralph Wiggum was Ralph Wiggum. He was the non sequitur machine.
The Fishmo baby Wurlamigig.
I wonder if they only had this scene in here to set up his parents that will appear later in the episode.
Yeah, I think so. For like the newer viewers, like these are their parents. These are his parents.
But it's a funny joke that he actually sees them kissing, and it's just like, wait, why would you be? Yeah, they definitely look like they would never have sex again.
Yeah, look like Franklin was unaware he was making out with his wife too.
But that little pause on him smiling, like that added even extra greatness to the joke there.
So for some reason, to calm his horniness and sadness, Jay goes to see Indecent Proposal 2. It's funny, they make so much fun of Roger Ebert.
It's a little mean.
One buffet table is just for him. I'm sure he took it in stride because he did the show later and they reviewed the show and they seemed to like it at the time. But a little mean fat joke here and there about him.
But also a joke about crooked critics colluding easily and not being ethical journalists.
Link, more like stink.
Ah, my favorite critic. This time we really need something quotable for our ads. How's this? This movie is so good it makes HUD look like Chud, and I loved Chud.
I love it. You haven't even seen the movie yet. I am going to report you to the National Film Critics Association.
Uh-huh. They're over there at the free buffet. Excuse me, folks. This buffet is just for Roger Ebert.
Damn. That's really good.
And I love all the guys at the buffet are all wearing the promo t-shirt now. They just all put the t-shirt on over their clothes.
It bums me out now, the brief stint I spent being a critic and reviewing things. That is the default perception of commenters of all critics.
Yeah. I mean, for as much shit as video game reviewers get, I think there are way more hack film reviewers who all they want is a headline. All they need is a headline, and that's it. Like Peter Travers.
What I'll say, there's an article. Blurb Horror is something that got ascribed to certain reviews, like Peter Travers, because you literally will see movie standees that have the logo of the movie and then just a giant printout of the Rolling Stone review filled with hyperbole, edge of my seat, heart in my throat. Non-stop thrill ride. Those
standing
are all Travers.
Up clapping. Yeah. You never see a film touch you like this.
I think it was back about 2000, 2001. A couple movies got busted for making up critics.
They did.
Yeah. So
and it was like, you didn't have to. There are tons of horror critics.
And so I want to see that for the last time ever, because I'll never ever write another review because I hate commenters that much. I have never in my life, inside and out of the industry, read about or heard about a critic being paid for his opinion. I've heard about critics falling over themselves to make a great quote, like that guy did.
Yeah.
Or I've heard about critics, Harry Knowles from Ain't It Cool News has a biography about being flown out to Madison Square Garden to see Godzilla, writing, I loved it. And then he saw it again, he's like, what the fuck was I thinking? Yeah. Like, this lavish treatment warped my goddamn brain, and I don't love this fucking movie. It's terrible.
It can happen to the best of us when you're a young critic who's just like, well, they flew me to Japan, or I got to meet all these celebrities. How could I not?
But
like
I've
this
never
thing?
Heard of a bot critic or a situation like that in my entire life. And I've asked publishers and distributors if they'd ever done it over lots of drinks, and no one ever had.
I like the clarification that he has to say, and I loved Chud, because you don't know if you love Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground.
That's a Weller reference.
Yeah.
And a movie no one loves.
Starring Daniel Stern, brother of Simpsons writer David Stern, and also maybe Diana can tell us this. What is HUD? I know what it's referring to, but do you know what the actual movie's about?
It's a Paul Newman movie.
Okay.
Patricia Neal, I want to say. And yeah.
Is it about the HUD?
No, it's not about the housing and urban development.
I thought it was.
It's about a guy, I think he's called HUD.
Yeah. Okay, well, that I'm not interested now.
It's good. It's a personal drama thing out in like West Texas or somewhere.
Hmm. Well, so he's
whatever, he's sexy, that's all I care about.
So he's seeing Indecent Proposal 2, which is a very quick sequel. They made it within 2 years of the last one, and I have the original scene and the scene they're parodying here. The Indecent Proposal, in case you didn't know, was the classic short story idea of just that a very rich man, played by Robert Redford, offers $1 million to sleep with the gorgeous wife of regular Woody Harrelson, played by Demi Moore. Though there's also there's a previous history between Robert Redford and Demi Moore's characters too. Mm-hmm. And then they accept, and bad things follow from that.
Oh, the jealousy, the tension.
Yes, but here are the two scenes next to each other.
Suppose I were to offer you $1 million. For one night with your wife.
I'd like to sleep with your wife, and I'm prepared to pay $6.
Last time you paid us $1 million.
I know. At the time, I was worth $1,006,000.
Really blowing it all.
That joke is great. The other joke is total ADR Simpsons season 4 yeah. crap, where it's like, this is just something they threw together at the yeah. last minute.
As the critic budget goes down in later episodes, they are so guilty of that, of like, we need 10 more seconds. Okay, cycle this guy going forward yeah. and backward and forward and backward, saying the words.
Christine Cavanaugh playing Demi Moore.
Yeah.
The late great, two dead.
There's a lot of dead people in this act.
Yeah. I just love that, because she usually only is like the central character, like mm-hmm. Babe or Tommy Pickles. No, Chucky.
Chucky.
But she plays like a bunch of tertiary characters in this episode.
Yes.
Her New Yorker character is my favorite thing of all time.
She gets a lot of workout as the secondary, as a voice in this episode. Like most, it kind of, I think, shows you how in most critic episodes, maybe there aren't a lot of women, unnamed women characters who get lines. And so when
I think there are, but wasn't she a guest? She's not a member
of
the
crew. No, she's a regular.
Yeah, she's a regular. She's
Marty. But Marty's not on it. Marty's barely on any episodes.
But she's still a regular on this as Marty.
I would say Christine Cavanaugh's probably on every episode okay. in some role.
That's right. Yeah. She's in the main credits. But
although it's weird that she's not even trying to do a Demi Moore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's
Demi
a little
Moore
raspier.
Famously has a throaty, raspy voice.
Yeah. I have one Chud connection I have to mention, or I can't live with myself.
Oh, I think I know what it is.
Yes, so Garrett Graham, who plays Franklin Sherman, played Bud in Chud 2, Bud the Chud. Which is like a zombie boob comedy. Garrett Graham was in a lot of shitty movies in the 80s. That's pretty much all he did.
Oh, that's so perfect. Then I feel like they knew they were referencing Chud and he'd been in it. But
I mean, Chud 2 is no Chud.
Yes.
And I love Chud.
Thank you and good night. Like, it was at least cute of Maurice LaMarche recognizing, like, this is an old vaudeville.
And I feel like it was the writer sort of just punching out, like, nope, that joke's over. Yep. We had to make this. Goodbye.
The Critic will be right back, you TV-addicted couch monkeys.
Watch my new show, The Critic, from the producers of The Simpsons. Only this time, they're sober. Ugh.
The Critic, coming soon.
It is a clever idea that Jay would find a sex buddy in the projectionist booth. Like, that would be, it'd be somebody he'd be around all the time, and constantly screening films.
He notices her stunning eyes, and that's her main feature that stands out.
And they are, like, the woman, because she doesn't have a name.
Let's just call her Miss Misery.
Misery has a really good design, especially around her eyes, that she is a pretty woman, but also drawn in the way that, like, you can see the kind of desperation in her. And
a little frumpy. Mm-hmm. A little frumpy, heavy.
But with gorgeous eyes. And he has sex with her, and there's the joke about her being disgusted when he takes off his shirt.
And there's a later joke about how you lasted an entire minute.
Yes. Yeah, well, so he tells Doris about it, and jokes like this.
Yeah.
Doris Grau would be dead in 2 years from smoking-related health issues, and so making her cough, and the joke is that she constantly smokes, it takes a darker tone.
Doris, I am about to do something very unprofessional. I am about to review a movie I didn't even see.
Why not?
Someone fell in love with me and couldn't wait.
You! Oh, my poor lung.
You can really hear an old woman's lungs rattling around in her body.
Oh, yeah.
They need to be retarded. Wow, did I just say the R
word?
Come
on, Chris.
There's two R's in there. Come on.
But that Doris Grau has that great voice, but the same way that all the bailiffs on Night Court had that same voice for the same reason.
I was a heavy smoker, and nothing cures a disgusting coughing fit like another cigarette. It's sad.
Yes, and it makes your breath smell amazing.
Ooh.
And then comes another great just one-off joke about how hideous Jay is.
You know, there are certain women who find my offbeat good looks very attractive.
And this is one of our monsters from Terror Time Theater. It takes 5 hours to apply all that makeup.
Ah! Idiots.
It's very similar to Bart selling Homer as the monster in the slanty shanty.
Oh my god, that's the exact same joke.
Two bits of gander.
You're right. Yeah. It is the exact same joke. Man, these hacks are repeating themselves.
How dare they? You have to wait at least 10 years to do that.
I mean, I'm sure you guys talked about it in the previous episode. You don't overlap what you think is a Simpsons joke, but it's actually a Critic joke.
I've been pointing them out.
It's happened a lot, yeah.
It just, to me, growing up on Looney Tunes, it's like, yeah, you'd repeat yourself. Gags go get given to different characters. That happens.
Yeah, well, this time it's not Wile E. Coyote, it's the wolf going after the sheep.
Yeah, exactly. Sam.
It's Sam the wolf, yeah. And there's a lame, like, Edward Plunge Your Hands is a lame joke.
I had that written down as, like, that's how you know this is really old, because that's the worst criticism of Tim Burton at this point.
Yeah.
That his shit is silly and dark. And
I prefer Edward Penis Hands. I think we all know that one.
And that's the funniest thing, that's the most scathing criticism they had of Tim Burton at the time. Who hasn't made an original movie in 15 fucking years?
Oh, man, you're right. Yeah. But then after Edward Plunge Your Hands, then Jay disgustingly tells his entire audience that he had sex.
He just has to, you know, get it all out there. He wants everyone to know, ha ha.
I would, dude. Next time I have sex, I'll brag about it on the podcast in 3 years.
But first, let's start with a film I saw just today, Indecent Proposal 2. Well, I didn't see all of it. For one glorious minute, I was doing the horizontal bop.
Oh, there goes my appetite. Would somebody please change the channel?
Hello, I'm William Shatner, and this is Celebrity Autopsy.
Oh, that's better.
This is my second favorite animated William Shatner, next to the Family Guy one, who can defy gravity by tucking his legs into his chest and moving around a lot.
Posing very quickly. Yeah, this is a parody of Rescue 911. I think this is where I first knew William Shatner from as a kid. He would just narrate these horror stories and reenactments of actual emergencies on CBS.
7 years. Can you believe it?
Really? Wow.
7 seasons, 180 episodes he's apparently the host of the whole thing.
It's got to be an easy job to just host that stuff. Of like, you could probably film like 10 episodes in a day. Of like, am I talking about now?
He'd just be like Puffy in a blazer and turtleneck leaning on a desk.
Somebody get me a trench coat and turn up the fog machine.
And that is the first and hardly the last time we will hear Maurice LaMarche's William Shatner.
It's a great Shatner.
Yeah, but it's this thing that just happens in the world of the Critic, that it gets more and more populated, not with who they want, what characters they want to write, but what ones they want to, what famous people they want to hear Maurice LaMarche do.
I mean, Animaniacs built an entire character and later series on a Maurice LaMarche impression because they loved it so much.
And rightly so. He is
a wonderful man.
It is the greatest. Yeah, it's probably the greatest impersonation of
Orson Welles.
Yeah. Where was my mind there? Why couldn't I say? All I had in my head was Citizen Kane. I was like, the best one.
Old Kaney himself.
And then he sees another movie. It's Honey, I Laminated the Kids, which again, a lame joke.
That's all right.
The visual of the laminated kids falling over is at least funny.
The animation makes it work.
I thought it was a funny Rick Moranis impression because it's an impression of his Lewis character from
Ghostbusters. Yeah.
And it just, I don't know, like, obviously I'm young and all these movies are really important to me, but I'm also a Disney apologist / I don't know, truthsayer. And all Disney's live action movies are shitty and not worth referencing and forgettable. Trust me, the same thing will happen to Jungle Book and Beauty and the Beast. But Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, pretty goddamn cool. Watch it again. It's no Flight of the Navigator.
They made you cry for an ant.
But it's a really high concept effects comedy that still looks awesome every single second of it. I watched it recently. I love Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Is it because there's a Roger Rabbit short before it, Chris?
Yeah, that's part of
it. I thought so.
That warmed tummy you trouble. Up for it.
Henry, sorry, I see that on your clip list. There's another joke that you hear a lot from comedy writers in TV.
Comedy writers love kicking down to this actress.
Is Jeremy Hawk in there? I'm supposed to have lunch with him.
Yes, but I can't let you in.
Look, I'm a powerful film critic and you're a lowly security guard. But if you treat people like me right, next year you could be head of this studio.
No, last year I was head of the studio. 12-picture deal with Shelley Long seemed like a good idea.
Oof. I love how this guy is like so close to being pimply faced teen.
Yes.
He literally has pimples. His voice cracks. It's like this guy's 16 and he was head of a studio.
I like how they have
because they're all morons.
They have their own pimply faced teen in the Critic universe. But Shelley Long, I think on 30-20-10 in the 87 part, she just left.
She just left. She's just been in a big movie with Bette Midler that I totally forget the name of.
Outrageous Fortune.
And it
was a huge deal then for an actress to leave a sitcom before she's supposed to, before their contract says.
I never thought of it as TV writers being bitter about it, because I wasn't watching Cheers. This is what I know about Shelley Long, that she left her show too early and didn't get more famous.
It's a lot of sour grapes to her for not being successful. Similarly, David Caruso is getting that same shit. But
yeah. I mean, it was the Sam and Diane dynamic, and I assume a lot of the writers thought the show would end if she left, and she didn't care if they lost their jobs or had to cancel the show.
Yeah, and so I think comedy writers of that generation did have an axe to grind with her a little bit. And
never thought of it like that.
And she would come back for the final episode of Cheers.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And this, I believe she even told the story like they had her back to make it a good finale, but no one wanted to talk to her, and she was treated as persona non grata on the set.
If you go 2 years back in time to the Simpsons episode Flaming Moe's, there's a very Shelley Long-like bartender who comes to join Moe's bar, and they make a joke about her leaving to go pursue a movie career.
Yes, they do so many jokes like that. Cheers itself had like five jokes
oh,
like
yeah.
that in it.
It would
like
come
the money
up
pit.
All the time.
But so he goes to the set and visits on set. I think Smith and Wesson is a great name for a buddy cop movie. It's really good. And that Jeremy and that Jay is really kind of an asshole, like, to walk onto the set during filming. That's
pretty
bad.
He's like, I'm a film critic, let me in.
And then when the guy yells at him, he tells him about what a bad actor he is,
because he can't not be critical. And then he's like, what do you know about acting? And then this kind of works. I almost wonder if the show had gone on longer, if unnamed woman would have been the Sideshow Bob of the show, because this is a murder mystery, or not a murder mystery, but it is a mystery show, and this sets up lines for later. Like, it is a mystery. It reminds me, you already compared it to Cape Fear, but it reminds me of the mystery elements of early Sideshow Bob episodes.
You're right, I can see that.
It was the weirdest thing. She just kept staring at me from the projection booth. Can I have your pickle?
Sure, they give me gas.
Me too. The whole thing is so thrilling. The platter of film going around. The danger of knowing Leonard Maltin could walk in at any moment.
Sounds fantastic.
It is. But just once, I wish you would talk to me.
Jay, Bubala, what relationship with a woman has ever been enhanced by having a conversation?
Hey, you don't understand. We Americans aren't like you Australians. It's not just about sex. We want to make love to our mothers.
Jeremy's disgusted look on his face.
On the commentary, they even recognize what a gross line that is. They're like, why were we on ABC with that disgusting line?
It is a very 1994 Fox joke.
Yes, but and also that the can I have your pickle, the way it comes back is pretty funny too.
Yep.
And but just that he's like, he admits it gives him gas,
and he's so
he likes
happy
it. He's
about
like,
it.
Me too.
Yay, gas. I love pickles, so I'm on board.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Why would Leonard Maltin come walking in? That would be rather rude of him to walk into the projection.
He's a very inquisitive guy. He's so friendly.
Maybe they didn't do a real change fast enough, and he's like, what the hell happened? And he goes back there and like, oh my God.
I thought you might like to know why this cartoon is racist.
That's his main job now. Well, no, his main job now is podcaster, which, hey, welcome to the brotherhood, buddy.
Yep.
I love you, Leonard Maltin. I love you.
So that's why Jay finally decides it's time to speak to the projectionist, and this is a great introduction of her voice.
Wait, for once we're going to have a conversation. What are your hopes? What are your dreams? Oh no, you have a weird voice. I knew it was too good to be true.
No, I just had a gummy bear stuck in my throat.
So that's Pamela Reed, who plays Ruth Powers on at least two episodes of The Simpsons up to this point.
Yes, the Simpsons' forgotten neighbor on the right side of the house to Flanders' left.
Right. And she's also in, Kindergarten Cop?
A bunch of others.
She's popped up on TV. She was on Parks and Rec. She'd pop up a bunch as Amy Poehler's mom.
She's got a great voice, though.
Yes, it's an amazing voice. Like, so it's a great sexy voice to hear. Well, not sexy, sure.
Not sexy.
But it's a great voice and very good casting. It also made me think of Sideshow Bob as well, and just how it's a languid voice you want to hear more of, and who can do great monologues of evil.
Yeah.
Pamela Reed had been on The Simpsons like 4 months before this. That was Marge on the Lam was her last appearance for many years.
She's stealing jokes and guest stars, Al Jean and Mike Reese?
No.
How low can you go? I'm just kidding. Being facetious.
Okay, so she seems very normal at this point. So knowing where she goes, like, this is all a ruse, which again makes her the second conniving woman in his life that he's been with. And it's just, The thoughts of women in the show, I don't know, man. It's
so far, not great.
I mean, Margot's cool. Like,
yeah, Margot's a very good character.
She feels like a James L. Brooks woman, while other women on the show maybe don't feel as James Brooks influenced. But so then Jay decides, no more of just this hanky-panky. He wants to get serious.
Maybe this could grow into something meaningful.
I don't know. Whenever I get into a relationship with a man, they tend to get dominating and overcritical.
I can see your point. Although I wouldn't have used overcritical, and I think your delivery was wooden and unconvincing.
Maybe you should go.
Wait, no, I don't want to lose this chance. Look, you're all I think about all week. I can't get those beautiful eyes out of my mind. Please, go out with me.
All right, why don't you come over to my place? We'll have some wine, cuddle by the fire, and watch Love Story.
Make it cookies, the refrigerator, and Eraserhead. And you've got a deal.
God, after seeing Eraserhead, the idea of Eraserhead on a first date.
Oh my God.
Is terrifying. I watched the first 20 minutes of the movie normally. I had to watch the rest of the movie on double play because it was excruciating. In a way that was intended, not that it was a bad movie. Like, this is hurting me, but I made it to the other end of Eraserhead. I'm a better person for it.
Wow, I'm impressed.
That is a bad date movie.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The reason, something about cookies in the refrigerator combined makes me think that they're just eating cookie dough. Well, and then watching Eraserhead, which I'm so on board with.
Well,
that sounds like a great date to me, but then I have problems.
Well, that even says in front of the refrigerator. So I was like, no, let's sit in front of the refrigerator.
Pull the TV into the kitchen.
And, but I also like the spirit of that, of having being asked to go see a date movie and somebody wanting to see a romantic thing. And then you say, like, you're in your brain, you're like, no, I want to see the best movie. And the best movie might not be romantic. And in fact, might end with, like, love dying or murder or whatever, but it's like, no, I want to see the best movie, not a love movie.
It's like, I can't think of any, there's only a couple more less romantic movies I can think of, like Shoah. That's about it. I mean, like,
Salo?
Yeah, Salo, 100
Days of Summer. Let's watch Human Centipede 3, honey.
Let's watch Funny Games, both versions.
But I didn't pick up on that joke because I'd never heard of the movie Love Story until I read Kid Stays in the Pictures, which gave the context of, like, that was what you called a faded phenomenon, like a really, really popular romantic film that I've never seen aired on cable, heard anyone my age talk about, but was really, really popular at the time.
Did you want to watch Love Story? No.
No.
Did you? You better believe it. Was it the best movie you ever saw? Perhaps it was.
You bet your ass.
Should I not let my girlfriend start a movie with Steve McQueen? You bet your ass.
It's about two beautiful people falling in love, and one of them dies, and that's basically it. And love means never having to say you're sorry. And I'm sorry for stealing that line from you, Henry.
You took it right out of my
mouth. I grabbed it with my psychic powers. I apologize. That was rude.
And it's also missing from this episode. I do wish Duke Phillips was in here somewhere. Having Charles Napier's voice, it's like, boy. And you mentioned on the commentary.
He's there. And they're like, we're sorry for bringing you on this commentary when there's no Duke scenes.
Yes. And in normal Jay fashion of season one, Jay can't have a relationship that is average for more than a minute on the show.
Yeah.
Like, that is the closest to a promise of a real date right there. He gets to her house, and it is full of Jay Sherman memorabilia, which I'm shocked Duke Phillips made all that memorabilia with his face.
It makes me mad that none exists for me to buy.
I feel like this says a lot. Like, there was once a lot of hype behind Jay and his show, but this is all old merchandise, like, from the 80s that's no longer in circulation. He's just sort of phoning it in now, or just sort of, like, I don't know, plateaued.
Like the Spuds McKenzie of film criticism.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I don't know if you guys paused it like I did to try to take in some of it.
No.
But
a little bit.
Yeah, there's a floor lamp. There's the Sexy Jay poster. There's a Jay Punching Clown. The VHS Rewinder, of course. A book called World According to Jay. Shermints. There's a decorative plate. Crispy Critters with him on the front. And People Magazine's Unsexiest Man Alive.
Well, Chris was mentioning his unique body and head shape. A lot of things are made out of that, like products, especially the tape rewinder that goes,
Well, here.
You seem to have a psychotic obsession with me. I like that in a woman.
I'm your biggest fan.
Wow, you even have the Jay Sherman videotape rewinder. Ahem!
And that's not all. Surprise! From when your book came out, I hooked it up to my clapper.
Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book! Yeah, they pulled him out of bookstores after Brentano's manager shot himself.
I'm giving that line to the show.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I just made that up.
I do like how
the show jingle piece.
So, like, three things about this joke. I love how it's not just the voice being silent. It's actually John Lovitz going bah! Like, stopping himself. Yeah. You know, like, the sign shouldn't be able to do that.
That's
Number two, I have to ask Diana this. Jay's book, What I Do in the Dark, is that a reference to Pauline Kael's I Lost It at the Movies?
Totally.
I think it is. Okay.
All of Pauline Kael's titles were sexualizing her movie experience. Like a dirty hussy. I love Pauline Kael's reviews. Like, I never read any of them when they were new because I wasn't reading the New Yorker when she retired.
She stopped
in
91.
But that I loved rereading her old reviews because I was like, well, I haven't read a review of The Seven Samurai when it was new, or I haven't read reviews of Star Wars when it was new, and what she felt about it.
That sounds really fun.
It's really interesting. And
her book on Citizen Kane is super good.
Yeah.
I read that.
And you could go to a used bookstore and probably find any number of like old collections of her reviews. She was the New Yorker's reviewer, right?
Yeah.
So one final thing, Brentano's is a bookstore I had no idea existed.
It's a fancy bookstore.
A New York-based chain, which I think spread out in America a bit. 1853 to 2011, they were eventually purchased by Walden Books, and through all the acquisitions, Borders bought them. We all know what happened to Borders. 2011, no more Brentano's. So Brentano's was a bookstore. I didn't know that until watching this episode.
It really confused me to hear Brentano's. Until now, I was like, because through context, you know it's the name of a book business, but I just never heard of it. Like, I went to Barnes & Noble and Books A Million, my two bookstores, they were right across the street from each other, actually, in my town.
There would not even be a chain bookstore in my town until, like, 2 years later.
Whoa.
And that was Barnes & Noble. No, I think there was a B. Dalton, maybe.
Now, there was a Brentano's in the Fancy Mall.
Ooh.
A little ways away. Not the closer mall that was dying, but the fancy one.
So, R.I.P. Brentano's.
The idea that Jay's voice drove someone to suicide is so dark. Like, that is a really... This is such a dark episode.
And it's not just one Buy My Book sound clip. It gets more intense. Like, Buy My Book! Buy My Book!
Yeah. It is dark.
Although, anytime I have to promote something, I end up quoting them.
I'm sure we'll use this for the Talking Simpsons Patreon.
Okay, so then he gets drugged by her. So again, not even a normal date for 30 seconds. He is drugged and...
Great animation, too. And also,
gorgeous animation.
It's beautiful. The spin around him? Is that what you mean?
Yeah,
a couple pieces. Yeah. I mean, there's the 360 looking over all the crazy memorabilia.
And to make that an animation, you have to have 6 feet of a background that you move the camera across.
Oh.
Like, yeah.
And then there's the spinning... But the shot where he takes the first drink and there's sort of a kind of a vertigo zoom into her face.
Yeah, great lighting.
It darkens on her and she gets this big smile. I feel like this is a specific reference, but the smile just makes me think of how the Grinch stole Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and her very careful holding of the wine to be like, I'm not drinking this wine. And though it makes me slightly squeamish when he falls onto the hors d'oeuvres, because I'm like,
ouch,
how did a toothpick not go into your eye? Like,
and we passed it up, but the line, I'm your biggest fan, is right from Misery.
Yes, that's true. So that's when I also mistook this as a Misery episode, that it is Misery after the first, in the third act, is really when it becomes Misery in its most direct.
Do we have this woman's origin story about why she kidnapped Jay?
Why, yes, we do.
Cool.
But though this really doesn't fit with the other ways she acts in this episode.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this to me?
I like every movie that comes out. People laugh at me and think I'm stupid. Now I have you to tell me what's good and what's bad.
Well, here's a clue for you. Tying me up is bad. Untying me would be good.
You're funny.
We'll be right back.
Right.
I love that cut to black.
So good.
So, I mean, logically, if you look at the storytelling here, it starts to make less sense. It's still a funny parody, but it's like she kidnaps him so he can tell her what movies are good and bad, but there's no reason that she should be killing him.
Yeah.
In Misery, she starts hurting the guy because he tries to escape and tries to, get
and
out.
He won't write the book she tells him to. That it starts easy with, like, it's so great in the Misery that it is death by a thousand cuts, that it starts with, like, well, I did save your life. Could you, maybe write a little bit? And then she rejects his first draft, and he's getting more and more scared until she's very direct, like, I will murder you if you don't write me the book I want.
Yeah.
But in this one, it's just her straight up saying, You can tell me what movies are good or bad. But she never asks him again about doing that.
She just is like, I'm going to start killing you now.
Yeah. And it is a good reason, a good story reason. Yes, it is a good story reason for her to kidnap Jay. But instead, they just forget it in the third act. Like, that was the commercial break and of her knocking him out. And it was pretty funny that it would have a meta moment like that of Jay telling the audience they'll be right back as he passes out.
I'm not dead.
Then there's a series of him passing out and being drugged over and over again by him. And
I like how they just spend 12 days on yes. a five-second yeah. joke.
Did you notice that when they say Jay's been missing, they always say more than 10 days? And I wonder if that's they wanted to give themselves the leeway of like, are we going to do the full joke that he's out for 13 days? Do we want them to say exactly he's been missing for 13 days? It's just weird that they always say more than 10 days. Jeremy gets enlisted in it, and his short height is completely contradicted in every other appearance he's in. Like, we've seen him without boots many times in later episodes.
He's kind of like 2.5 feet shorter without his lifts on or whatever.
And which is appropriate because there's plenty of stars you imagine being really tall, and they're like, 5'7", 5'8".
It's a classic Hollywood joke of how short Tom Cruise is, but you never know that because of how they film him meticulously in every film to be like, no, he's not that tall.
Yeah. Or Sylvester Stallone. Yeah. Harrison Ford's like 5'9". I mean, they're not big guys. We just think Schwarzenegger too. I think he's like 6'1".
The only celebrity I've ever met, I just always assume I'm not tall, I guess. The only one I've ever met that is taller than me is Hulk Hogan. That man dimension of him is bigger than me.
It is the opposite situation for me with pro wrestlers because I'm used to seeing all these giants in the ring with each other. So you all think they're all the same relative height, and then when you meet the guys who you think are normal in real life, you're like, oh, you're 2 inches taller than me and have 100 more pounds of muscle.
He was a monster.
And then when you meet the big guys, you're like, you are a foot taller than me and have 200 pounds of muscle on you. Like, it's crazy. I did the visual of Jeremy running at the slant.
It's good animation.
It's ridiculous, though, but it is pretty funny.
Hey, you've never run with a broken heel. What do you know?
You're right.
It's very hard. I go full 45 degrees on my bad foot.
Yeah, she decides to kill him at that point, and though the bad haircut, I wouldn't have done that joke because his hair has to revert for the rest of the scenes, or else he's going to have that haircut the rest of the episode.
They do draw him with the bad haircut, right, for the rest of the show?
No, they don't.
Oh, they don't? Okay, no. I forgot to check. Because
she cuts
like
his hair completely off.
Yeah.
Like, balding head is now completely bald, but only when after he says, what can I get you? A hat. That's the end.
I like it better when we're just having sex.
Yeah, Jeremy has his enemies list, which this is the first time I ever got this joke.
Me too, and I want to say this joke is way too smart for the ABC audience tuning in.
Way too much.
My. Did Jay have any enemies?
Let's see, Rob Lowe, Steven Seagal, Dr. Hangus Nagore.
If you ask me, he should have gone to the acting fields.
Oh, that's cruel.
This joke makes Jay seem like the biggest asshole on the planet. This
explanation, please.
Okay, so Dr. Hangus Nagore is a Cambodian doctor, was a Cambodian doctor, I should say, RIP, who basically he lived a horrible, horrible existence under the Khmer Rouge, and then he, as a non-professional, got star in The Killing Fields, a movie about
he had escaped, and he was a refugee.
Yeah, killing 2 million other people, something more like that. And it's a grueling movie. He's basically reenacting a lot of the horrible shit that he went through. And he won an Oscar, and he had, kind of a small acting career, and then he was murdered.
He was murdered in February of 1996. Luckily, makes this joke even darker in retrospect.
They found the people and they went to jail and everything, so it was solved. But I was reading about him and I knew the name, and it's hard to parse with Jeremy's Australian accent and this foreign name on top of it. But I was like, okay, I know The Killing Fields. And I was reading, this guy survived 3 terms in Cambodian prison camps using his doctor training, doing things like eating bugs to stay alive. Like, these were death camps.
Holy shit, I think I saw this movie.
The Killing Fields?
Probably.
I don't remember it. But I remember a guy eating cockroaches to survive.
Was there a Simpsons reference to this guy? I thought there was at some
point. Yeah, yeah. Homer has his Oscar and tried to scratch out Dr. Hangus Nagore's name.
That's right. Shit. Which episode was that, Diana?
Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So he has it in Team Homer, which I think that maybe aired after Hengist Nagore had been killed.
That was a 1990, early 96 or late 95 episode, okay. So I don't think they could have known. Or,
well, maybe not in the anime, but it takes on a much darker joke there, too, if Homer stole the Oscar of a dead man.
Homer was the assailant, oh my God. Yes.
Son of a bitch. Oh, also, which I remember is we're going by when Jeremy talks about, you know, why he's best friends with Jay. He mentions because Jay gave a good review to his very first movie, Keg Party at Hanging Rock, which I love that joke. Yeah. It goes by so fast. He just mentions it. It's like, he goes, Also, I love Picnic at Hanging Rock. I like the book. I love the movie.
And that Keg, it sounds
another
like
thing
the...
I didn't get. Picnic at Hanging Rock?
Yeah, Picnic at Hanging Rock. It's about these girls at a girls' school at like the turn of the century in outback in Australia, and they go to have this picnic at Hanging Rock, and then a couple of them go missing, and the paranoia and weird shit going on at the school kind of makes everyone go crazy. It's really, really good.
Is the joke film? Is the joke about Jeremy? Is like all the Australian versions of stuff are just full of drinking and like lechery?
I guess, but this is an Australian film.
Yeah,
but it's like
directed
maybe
by
this
Peter
is
Weir.
Exactly, Peter Weir, great director. But it's like, this is like the boob comedy version or something.
I like the implication, too, that his first, obviously Jeremy's first film would have been in Australia, and then he moves to America to act. But that's all inferred just from the title of that, and I like that. Yeah. And then when he's at the cop station, too, once again, a movie scene breaks out in real life in this world. And
it's not a direct reference, but it is just like a generic cop scene.
Yes,
G for garbage.
It's not that funny, so I didn't clip it. But close to my favorite line of the show is the talking cat section of Jay thinking he had somebody to talk to.
Well, bless my soul, one of my cats has learned to talk. I knew if I lived 85 years, something interesting would happen.
I'm not a cat, I'm a film critic.
Well, now that's no job for a talking cat.
Lady, don't take this the wrong way, but you're nuts.
Oh, you sound just like the toaster.
So you see, looking back, I think the other kids always picked me last for sports because I was smarter than them, not because of my unpredictable bladder. What do you think, Esther?
You talk too much, talking cat.
That cat is dead.
Throws the cat out the window. Well, we don't know how many floors up they
are.
That's
true. It could have landed on like some sort of cat safety netting or garbage pile.
Again, such a dark show, they kill a cat.
Jay got a cat killed with his voice.
And, you know, as a fat guy, I hate when they add extra things on top of that. Like, the kids could have just picked him last because he was fat, but they also have to be like, no, Jay peed his pants a lot as a kid, too.
Yeah,
like,
he's extra horrible. Yes. It's not just that he's fat. That would be fun.
You were better than Jay
he's
Sherman,
horrible.
Henry.
Yeah.
The one advantage he has over Homer Simpson is that he's smart, but everything else supersedes that. Like, his gas. I mean, they made a joke about him farting earlier. He pees himself. Like, he has every problem.
He's 3'2", but constantly confused with a universal monster.
Yeah.
It reminds me on Freaks and Geeks where... nobody wanted to be friends with the fat kid, but it was because he had BO. And I was like, they could just not like him for being fat. You don't have to make the fat kid smelly.
But actually, they explain in an episode it's a medical condition, and the kid tells them about it, and then they feel really bad. He's like, I know I smell. This is why. And they're like,
He says, like, well, you know, my mom says it's a way to weed out the jerks. And it was that kid is also known as being the head of head of the fat kids camp in the classic Buddhist versus fat kids camp.
Mr. Show sketch?
And Mr. Sketch.
He was decapitated.
Show, that's right, he was decapitated. He was.
Not the actor, the
character.
No, his throat was slit.
Yeah.
And then Jeremy is throwing a press conference to try to find Jay, but nobody wants to talk about Jay because everyone loves Jeremy and hates Jay.
I'm here because film critic Jay Sherman has been missing for more than 10 days and we have no leads. Any questions?
Is it true you fired the caterer on your movie for bringing you the wrong kind of biscuit?
Hey, my lawyer has instructed me not to answer any questions relating to tea biscuits, scones, or figgy pudding. Besides, we're here to talk about Jay Sherman.
If Jay Sherman was the wrong kind of biscuit, would you fire the man who served him to you?
Well, that's better. Wait a minute.
That's really good.
That's a great joke about like being a reporter and asking a leading question like that.
I was sad that Algina Mike Reese could not remember which incident this is based on. It happened to somebody on some set. They were given the wrong food item and someone was fired over it.
I wish it was the silliest thing I heard someone say at a podium recently.
But it isn't.
Yeah, I didn't fire the guy who brought me the wrong biscuit, but everybody says it'd be okay if I did.
Yeah.
No, everybody, Toby.
I did nothing wrong if I did do that. But I mean, that's. I feel like there's been a million Hollywood stories about that, or scenes in movies making fun of prissy actors who are just like, that's not my bottled water.
Yeah.
That's not my favorite.
Yeah.
That's not the Fanta I like. No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then it's fair because these reporters are terrible.
Yes.
I mean, I love that, yeah, Eleanor comes out and screams at them, but then they take everything wrong out of the story. They focus only on the dumb parts.
Yes. Well, I just love that I love that the newspapers say, like, have you seen this actor's friend?
Yep.
But, but yes, Jay's parents get to talk to the press in another very cartoonish moment.
Please, Mrs. Sherman, for the good of your son, don't hold back your emotions.
I understand. I think you media jackals are a pack of filthy, muckraking scum. What you did to poor Dan Quayle is a disgrace. I hate you all, except for you good people at the New Yorker.
Bravo, Mrs. S.
And now Jay's father would like to say a few words.
If I could be a vegetable, I'd be a carrot.
So in that scene, we have three people talking with that aristocratic flair.
Yes, that's true. But that one is
transatlantic.
One is the cartoon New Yorker drawing who
Bravo,
lives in
Mrs.
the
S.
real world.
Yeah,
like, it's, he has a press pass. It's wonderful.
I wouldn't say that the New Yorker living in the real world is more silly than the Easter Island kids we'll meet later,
or like, Do the Right Thing happening in real life,
yep.
Or a giant blue whale dropping on Jay out of the sky.
That's true, too.
I love that she's mad about how the media treated Dan Quayle.
Yes, that's so great.
A man who, he has no fans. That's impossible.
No.
His wife doesn't even like him.
No, not really.
And just remember that Franklin was, I believe, governor of New York at
yes.
one point. So
yeah.
they're not stopping to be like, oh, it's the former governor's talking. Like, none of the newspapers.
I forgot about that. Maybe that's why they... It takes away from the joke. That's why, of course, why they write everything down and take pictures.
Well, it's a season two episode that establishes it. I think they didn't care for that at the first point, but they just needed to, in the season two episode where Duke Phillips runs for president, for him to take Franklin as his vice president, they had to give Franklin some sort of political background.
I think that was a reference to Perot's vice president,
yes.
too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I love the...
Who am I? Why am I here?
The headline, I miss my baby carrot.
I love that. Closest to the scene-for-scene misery stuff is the failed escape and the trying to get a knife, and then the failed escape being punished with smashing his feet. Mm. And I think here's my theory that so they animated the full setup of the breaking of the legs, and it just cuts away on the no. Mm-hmm. And I think they realized it was too dark that then they added the new scene of him waking up and his feet are fine.
Yeah.
Because it's all reused animation. It's all shots they
You're
used
right.
before.
Actually, this confused me. I was like, did she break his legs or not? Because
she didn't.
Yeah.
She didn't.
Yeah.
No.
That his, but then why did she set up to do it
and then
not
do it? Yeah, that's what I was asking.
So I feel like they were just told, no, just don't do that. Like,
oh, yeah,
this is too dark.
You're right, Henry. And Jay walks with a limp for a different reason at
yes,
the end.
Right.
Yeah,
that she can't do direct bodily harm. Like all her other, the cutting his hair thing and knocking him out, it's not the same as direct physical abuse of breaking
feet.
It's more non-violent, sort of. I mean, it's not good. You shouldn't torture someone like that. But I feel like this. Maybe the censors of the network told them, like, you got to tone this back. Like, she can't actually break his
feet. I told
my
anecdotes all out of order because that scene it's based on is genuinely disturbing to watch.
Oh, it's a great movie.
I don't know how you could depict that even off screen.
And just the order of him asking, like, what happened to my legs? They're so swollen. Like, nothing.
I retain water.
It felt very much like how they it reminded me so much of how they re-edited extra jokes into the Treehouse of Horrors in season 4.
Yeah.
Like, all the recycled, like, that's good, that's bad. Like, it was totally the way Al Jean and Mike Reiss added new scenes.
They're very much still in that mentality. And do you have the clip of the crazy movie Jeremy Hawke is in?
No, I do not.
I have the quote. He runs into the Supreme Court room with a bazooka.
Yes.
And he says, so you're the 9 liberal judges who outlawed unreasonable search and seizure.
Yes.
It was Souter.
Souter.
Yeah, so it's a movie. We don't get a title for it, I don't think.
No, we don't get a title.
But apparently it stars the actual 9 Supreme Court justices at the time.
Yes, it was so strange.
And they all blame Souter, the mildest, most boring one of them all. Cottage cheese as a human.
He said the 9 liberal justices. There's never been 9 liberal justices. No. Like, I'm not a SCOTUS historian, but I feel like it's always been pretty balanced.
With the way the movie's being portrayed, it feels like an ultra-conservative take. It's like, all these judges are liberals.
Yes.
Because they outlawed unreasonable search and seizure.
Commie Rehnquist and his Fourth Amendment.
And it's also strange that Jeremy is going to his own movie and watching it. Like, he needs
a break from looking for Jay. He's got to take his mind off things, and he's a narcissist.
Also, why is Smith and Wesson filming in New York City? Why do so many of his films be done in New York City? Like, they didn't film that much in 90. They film some stuff.
Not as much as they do now.
Yeah, they do it in L.A. or Lithuania. Now every movie's filmed in Atlanta because they get the best tax credits.
And every half-hour TV show is shot in New York.
Film New York works much better than Flim Springfield.
I guess Ethan notices her and she leaves the production booth.
So he notices her eyes, flashes back to that pickle scene, and it only takes them 2 episodes to have a taxi reference.
Yep.
Which they never really did on The Simpsons in those early years.
And I didn't get this at all because I didn't see Taxi till after the critic was off the air.
Yeah, me too. I didn't see it until it was like reruns on Nick at Night. Yeah.
Really, great show. Really, really
super
strong.
Good. And James L. Brooks, right?
James L. Brooks and Sam Simon. He ran the
latest showrunner ever on the show Taxi. Mm-hmm.
The opening was very sweet, unlike the show was just a workplace comedy of mean people saying stuff to each other.
With the most insane cast ever, if you look back.
An incredible cast.
With the possible exception of Marilyn Hemingway, who I love.
I love her. No way. She's
Christopher Lloyd, Judd Hirsch, Tony Danza, Danny DeVito, occasional Andy Kaufman. Am I missing anybody?
No, Andy Kaufman became a full regular.
Yeah. You said Danny DeVito. Jeff Conway is probably the one who didn't break through.
Oh, he's dead. We can speak it.
Miriam Hemingway's ahead of him, and she never forgets, too. Like an elephant.
She's the queen of Mensa. Well, there's a great joke here that's still relevant, and too relevant today, that Jeremy needs a gun and gets one from a vending machine, and behind him are like a crazy person, a KKK member,
And a really little kid.
Not to date the show, there were 2 spree killings yesterday in America. And the reaction is, you can't talk about how guns are too easy to get. They're doing this like 25 years ago. Come on, people. Yes, the answers are here, and we know what the answers are.
The answers are that a good guy with a gun will stop a bad guy with a gun, right?
Always. That's they never shoot their children on accident.
You never know when tyranny's going to pop up.
Yeah.
Boy.
And,
anyway, you
can take out those government takes and heat rays with your Smith & Wesson, so it's fine.
Okay.
So then Jeremy sort of saves Jay, but Jay saves himself in pretty much a way to avoid violence being done to a woman as best they can.
But this is also recreating the scene from Smith & Wesson that we saw at the beginning of the show.
It is a great callback.
Drop that knife!
Jeremy, you're just an actor. You don't know how to use that thing.
It's just a gun, for God's sakes, not a bloody Xerox machine.
Ow! Idiot.
Whoops. Can we take that again?
She attacks.
Buy my book!
Sorry, it had to be done.
Why? All he said was, buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book! I'll be quiet.
You know, now I think the Brentano's manager killed himself with the J. Sherman standee. He put a knife on it or something and just cut his own head off because, man, that thing can knock out a full-grown woman.
Yeah. So at the end of Misery, it is a brutal, nasty fight between James Caan and Kathy Bates.
She takes a typewriter to the face, right?
So he thinks he can kill her the first time with, like, while she's putting out the... This is big spoilers for Misery, sorry. But while she's putting out the fire, he smashes her with the typewriter. Perfect, like, metaphor for it. Like, he's using his words against her to defeat her. But it doesn't immediately kill her, and he's in a wheelchair, and she's trying to strangle him. It's also when she finally swears in the whole movie. She's like, you cocksucker, you lying cocksucker. Sucker, she says.
She drops the cock-a-doodie facade.
And then they're just rolling around trying to beat each other to death, and then he beats her by tripping her, and then she falls and breaks her skull on the typewriter.
It's brutal. I love it.
So it's such a brutal grade. So again, Misery, sorry. I want to read the book now. I got to read
the book. The book is great. It's a quick read for a Stephen King book, too.
Oh, really?
It's only 300 pages.
Wow, that's basically a novella on his part. But... And then they again recreate the last scene from Misery, except make it more humorous in that it's 6 months later. Jay is walking with a cane he will never use ever again. So I guess he rehabilitated pretty quickly.
And his legs weren't broken.
For a guy as out of shape as he is, I would think rehabilitation would take him a very long time.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, but Jeremy shoots him in the leg. And I forget, what is the last scene in Misery? Is it that James Caan now sees her everywhere because he's...
Well, he has PTSD. PTSD, so he's... He's selling his new book that is not the Misery series, mm-hmm. or at a fancy dinner, and then a woman comes up and he thinks it's Kathy Bates, mm-hmm. and then he like blinks and realizes it's not her, but she's now he doesn't know, like, she's everywhere. Like,
and
who knows?
Could be anybody. She introduces herself as his biggest fan.
So any fan is now a risk, except at the end of this one.
So this time the projectionist arrives, but it is her, and she sits down with him. And
this will not make any sense if you haven't seen Misery.
But it's a happy ending.
So how is prison?
Well, they treated me pretty bad at first, but then they found out I tried to kill a film critic. You know, in Texas, it's not even a crime.
I'm well aware. At the Houston Film Festival, only half of us got out alive. Don't hit me.
I love that. I love that.
I mean, Chris, you said it doesn't make any sense if you don't know the movie, but I mean, I didn't see the movie before watching this. And it makes sense because if you don't get the reference, it's still Jay's pathetic enough to ask the woman out again.
It is.
Who held him captive and tried to kill him and tortured him.
Yeah.
But
you're right.
She did have sex with him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So worth a second date.
At least, like, three glorious minutes of total sex.
Give it a try.
Yeah, that he...
It's called having no standards.
Exactly. I mean, Jay can't afford him. He really can't. This is the kind of desperate, miserable, sad Jay that they had to attack and end in season two, where they're like, no, he has a regular girlfriend. He is likable enough to have a regular girlfriend. But it's a great, super dark joke. And to reference two things that would come back in later, or that are returning from Simpsons bits, I think when he says, is well aware, most of us didn't make it out alive, it reminded me of when Krusty was explaining the Lubbock, Texas meaning of Jewish clowns, and how not only that he lost so many Jewish clowns
there. There are big shoes everywhere.
No.
And then it also reminded me of Larry, the looter game that Bart plays with Mrs. Power's daughter, and he goes like, do the change of venue button. Oh no, we're in Texas. It's just,
oh, that was Escape from Death Row.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. But Gene and Reese love joking about Texas and the horrors of Texas.
You can almost say this comes back around with the Iraq Film Festival episode. Ah. Another one about film critics trying to escape.
That's true. Yeah, that's pretty good.
So that was Miserable, the second production episode, fourth to air on ABC. And that was excellent. And as you probably know, you're listening to this if you're subscribing to our Patreon. Thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah.
And hopefully by this point, I don't know by this point you're listening to it, we will have met our goal, but hopefully we'll be able to do this soon as a full series, right?
Yes, yeah. I hope so too. So that's why no plugs really needed on this, though. Well, not for me and Bob to plug more Talking Simpsons stuff, but do you guys want to tell people about the things you do?
Yeah, Laser Time stuff. But I will say, like, if you're hearing this, that means you're probably a patron.
Or you stole it.
Oh, yes, stole it. But maybe share the YouTube video or the link to the Patreon with someone who else might support it, not be aware it exists. If they want a critic show, only you can make it happen.
And hopefully next time Michael will be able to come back, Mr. Diana Goodman.
And if people don't support it, I'm just going to keep doing it in my own living room, and you won't be able to hear it. So
thankfully, it is illegal to kill game critics in L.A., so Michael is safe. Geez.
Oh, I hope so. Knock on wood.
I'll plug Vigigame Apocalypse because Michael... thank God he's not here because of his commitment to goddamn video games, and I got to be on an episode for once. It's the second episode.
And we quit video games to do this, so it all comes together.
And oh yeah, one last note I wanted to say. This is the second episode. So the first episode ended, the credits end with one last joke.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, it was a squeaky voice teen telling him to leave. But all the other episodes have a normal voice guy telling him to leave.
Excuse me, sir. Show's over.
And I wonder if that was them going like, we don't want to have Simpsons has such a squeaky voice teen. We can't have this marquee moment with a squeaky voice.
Yeah, I mean, they already have one squeaky voice teen in this episode.
Totally.
Yeah, so. That was Talking Critic. Thank you so much for listening. If we meet our goals, we'll be back next time with the third episode. So hopefully we'll see you then.
Excuse me, sir. The show's over.
But I have nowhere to go.